It's Wednesday, August 22nd, 2018, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Safe Spaces in Public Places. A candidate for Congress bars the media from covering a town hall meeting open to the public. We'll talk about why this might be a problem. A Florida judge smacks down the South Florida Sun Sentinel for publishing info that that paper obtained legally about the Parkland school shooter. And ESPN fights to fix its relationship with the NFL. Why the network's president wants less political talk and more pigskin. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up, but let's start with yesterday's breaking news trifecta. In one federal courtroom, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort was found guilty on 8 of the 18 counts against him. In another courtroom, the president's former attorney and fixer entered a guilty plea admitting to tax evasion. And then in Iowa, word that there had been advancement in the case of missing woman Molly Tibbetts and how that even tied into the news with Trump at one point. It was a head-spinning afternoon. I was trying to write this show, and it seemed that every time I thought I had a lead, something changed. Every time that everybody was just running in ways we never expected yesterday.
Yeah, and in some ways, with all of the headlines for the past 18 months suggesting this breaking news story is this the biggest breaking news story, it almost sounds like the boy crying wolf. But that story was the biggest story in a long time because it brought the president.
Which one? We had three.
Well,
so how did they come together to make one? How did they come together to make one? Maybe that becomes the first question.
Okay, so all three of them were important. One, because the Cohen case brought the president directly into alleged criminal activity. Okay, Manafort's being found guilty sets him up to be squeezed by Mueller to testify or for members of Congress to call him in and testify. And the Molly Tibbetts case was not only used as sort of a deflection by Fox News, but it also showed the divide because a lot of news organizations that were not Fox News, I would argue, didn't give that story the coverage it deserved, though it got way more coverage from Fox than it should have at the time.
Yeah, and you know, I think the thing that sort of jumped out at me was that, you know, as Mike just alluded to, when you look at Manafort and you look at Cohen, I mean, now all of a sudden, especially in light of the election that's coming up, if the Democrats wind up taking the House, I mean, there may be some evidence for them to look at in terms of if Mueller heads in this direction, some evidence for them to look at in terms of Senate hearing. I mean, not just Senate, House hearings, in terms of possible impeachment, which, you know, at one point they were talking about, you know, profusely, and then they sort of backed off because they thought it might hurt them in elections. Well, now all of a sudden that issue may come back into play for the November elections in light of what's happening. So I mean, it was a I would say not a good day for the president, but a good day for many of his adversaries.
One of the things I was looking for last night was to see what happened at that West Virginia rally, to see what the president himself said, and I was surprised to see that MSNBC and CNN didn't take it live as they had other ones in the past.
Well, and they have basically not been taking them live for a while.
Yesterday was a newsworthy day in which it would have made sense to.
Yeah, I agree with that. And they did get the president coming off the plane, who sort of like in the inverse order of the importance to him, he talked about Manafort, didn't talk about Cohen.
No.
And then he didn't talk about really either one of them very much in his speech. He talked about Molly Tibbetts.
Yeah, I mean, the Molly Tibbetts feeds into, you know, sort of his punchline. So, and the things that he's been talking about, so I expected him to talk about that. I did expect him to, you know, not to talk about the other two because they went against him, and he wasn't going to bring that up. I mean, he did tweet out later on about Cohen that, you know, no one should hire him as an attorney. Well, you know, that.
Well, he's also now pled guilty to federal crimes. I don't know that I would have hired him today as my attorney.
Absolutely.
But
I have to say, though, and maybe this doesn't make anybody happy, but I think that news organizations on all sides of the spectrum, if you will, handled the Molly Tibbetts case poorly.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more about that.
So first of all, for anybody who doesn't know what that story is, a young college student from Iowa found, her body was found, believed murdered by an undocumented worker here in Iowa. Seized upon, of course, by the president and his supporters, Fox News, because that development came down at about the same time as the Manafort and Cohen cases did, they ran that story ahead of the Manafort and Cohen cases for a few minutes and certainly focused more attention on that story online than anybody else. I have to say, though, that I think almost the reaction to it from other news organizations, MSNBC, CNN, others, they downplayed the Tibbetts story, whether or not it would have been big to begin with. There was a lot of attention in Iowa on it. The vice president had met with the father prior to any of this stuff happening. The person accused of the killing, whether we like the narrative or think that it's wrongly reinforces a stereotype about illegal immigrants or whatever, that is a fact of that case. And it probably should have been reported because there are lots of people in Iowa and elsewhere who care about the young woman and who also care about this issue and how the media appear to be framing it or not covering it.
But, you know, Mike, here's the issue that I have with that. We have murders that happen in this country every single day. And a lot of those murders are covered by local news in those particular areas where they occur. And to highlight this one because the president and the vice president and others are using it as a political weapon to talk about immigration, to talk about... I have a problem with that. I mean, I agree with you in terms of the way in which the media, both Fox and others, you know, did or did not cover it. I understand that. But I have a serious problem when all of a sudden this particular case, this particular crime gets overshadowed because of its political implications, as opposed to the fact that we have murders that happen in our country every single day across the scale.
I don't disagree with you. My only argument would be Fox News overplayed it for obvious
Absolutely
political
related.
Reasons,
right.
But other news organizations, I would argue, underplayed it because it contributed to a narrative that they find distasteful
right.
about illegal immigrants.
Right.
If it were a different day, don't you think they would have perhaps played it differently, though? I think about two very important, pivotal men who were at the top echelon with the highest level of access to the man who became president of the United States being either convicted or admitting to felonies. On a different day, I think that story would have gotten a very different level of play, and that this maybe just became a victim of the news of the day. And what is the story with the greater level of impact?
But I also think what happened here was that the fact that the Tibbetts case came mm-hmm. down gave Fox News, which we all agree,
it gave them the point to be able to
deflect. Support of the president, absolutely. They used that case to provide cover to the president for the other two events that happened yesterday. And I can't imagine mm-hmm. that would have played out any other way. Looking at the scenario in which everything
and
played out
yesterday,
and I agree
with you on that. I think on a different day, CNN and MSNBC and the nation's newspapers outside of Iowa would have given it that same level of attention that perhaps it would have duly deserved.
I think
on a different day.
You may be right, and that would perhaps have been the inclination of those news organizations. But what's going to be a normal news day anytime in
the
future?
We haven't had one in two and a half years.
Fair enough. Well, last Wednesday, we were waiting to see what would unfold in the nation's newspapers as that coordinated effort to publish editorials fighting for the freedom of the press was carried out. Both papers here in Columbia had an op-ed, including one that was in the Missourian, written by Catherine Reed, that detailed the story of a Missourian reporter who was spit on while covering the primary election earlier this month. Now, the three of us know we're not the enemy, and in so many ways, we just want folks to see and understand that we are just like them, like the public that is our audience. We're living and working and raising our families in the same communities that they live in. And we're working to hold those who run our cities and counties and states accountable. We get it, but not everyone did. Just as we predicted last week, there was still a lot of anti-press rhetoric that surrounded those.
I don't think the three of us expected that to change. I mean, that kind of sentiment has been fermented for a while. And so when the news organizations, mainly newspapers, presented these editorials, of course you were going to get that pushback. You were going to get the continuing narrative of enemy of the people. And now, led by the president, the newspapers and the news organizations are seen as being part of a collusion conspiracy against the president. So now that narrative is starting to feed into the larger narrative of the press against Trump and his supporters.
I understand the impulse of the newspapers and others to want to come out and have a unified front. I think the attacks on the media from the president and his supporters are going to have lasting harmful consequences, but I also kind of think there are a lot of news organizations that have this fantasy that they're kind of like Ralphie in the movie A Christmas Story, when Scott Farkas, the big bully, you know, is pounding on him, and finally Ralphie decides he's going to get even, and so he starts beating up on the bully, and then all the friends gather around and say, yay, go, Ralphie. I don't think that the public is going to respond to us as being the Ralphies in that situation. They're not going to say, oh, the bully's picking on you. You have a right to go out there and push back any way you want. What news organizations need to do, as how many times have we said this on the broken record, shine the spotlight on how the Trump administration is affecting real people, not how he's affecting journalists.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, well, you do just win the day in the show for the first ever Christmas Story comparison and illusion. I'm going to be thinking about Ralphie all day. Stock. Anyway, we've talked about this.
He had yellow eyes.
We're going to lose it right here. We've talked about this one in the past, two candidates who are running for public office or holding public office, having meetings with voters or constituents, making them open to the public, but choosing to keep reporters out. The latest to pull this one, a Democratic congressional candidate, her name, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she's running in New York and last week kept reporters out of two listening tour sessions she was holding in Queens. Her justification? She wanted to create a safe space to meet with undocumented immigrants and women who have faced relationship violence without potentially identifying them to the reporters in the room who might then identify them and create a potentially precarious situation. I can understand her thinking, but I still can't necessarily defend the action.
I would have a hard time defending it as well. I mean, you know, politicians from both parties,
it's time for us to pick on the left a little bit too, because we pick on the right for doing this.
Absolutely, but all political persuasions have had closed sessions with donors and supporters and that sort of thing. But when you announce that you are going to have an event and it is open to the public, that means it is open to the media. And it for her to come back, for her staff to say, well, it's open to everybody but you, when you've announced that it's open to the public, you have a problem. And it doesn't, like I said, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, Socialists, whatever. When you open it to the public, you open it to the media.
I agree. And I just ask two other questions. One, do you really think it's that much more of a safe space at a large public event where the only folks excluded are the journalists? If you're a woman coming in wanting to talk about sexual violence or whatever, wouldn't maybe a small group meeting or individual opportunities for constituents to meet with her be the better way? And second of all, I would just say,
or meetings in a private home.
But also, if you listen to what her campaign manager was quoted as saying in the New York Post after this thing happened, said that, the candidate was mobbed by reporters at a previous meeting, even though she had said there would be no Q&A and no one-on-one interviews. And so that's why she banned the press. That's a whole lot less, well, that's a more self-serving account than the one she gave us.
And chances are she's likely going to end up winning this seat.
Well, yes.
So what happens then when she gets to Congress? And if she can't handle those questions or what she's viewing as the media mobbing her in Queens at a community center, what happens when she's up on the Hill?
Well, I mean, it becomes a problem.
I
think it's one of those things where, you know, if you're going to be a part of the political establishment in this country today, you need to go in understanding that you're going to have to answer questions from the media, whether you think they support you or they're against you. I mean, it's just a matter of life in politics.
Agreed. But she obviously doesn't want to be seen as part of the political establishment. And I think there are a fair number of folks on the left who find that attacking the media works just as well for them with certain folks as it does coming from the
right. I agree. And I think you're going to see more of that happening from the left as things begin to change, if this so-called blue wave is mm-hmm. going to happen in November.
Interestingly enough, though, I kind of think about it, and this just occurred to me as we're talking about this. You would think strategically it makes more sense to keep it open to the media and not find yourself potentially infiltrated by a group like Veritas that we had talked about in the past, where somebody is sending a concerned community member that you then find out is an operative who's looking. Better to have the media there as the true fourth estate.
Right.
To report fairly.
Or you don't even have to have Veritas. I mean, you could just have someone who's there who's just a member of the public.
Yeah,
and
doing the same thing.
And the candidate or the politician starts saying something like, oh, wait a minute, I want to catch that. And mm-hmm. boom, and then they put it out on their Facebook page or wherever. And now all of a sudden, you know, what you said is that there's not any other form of media there to say, hey, wait a minute, here's the context. Yeah. Of what actually happened.
Again. Yep. You did. Last week in a Florida courtroom, as a Broward County judge went after the South Florida Sun Sentinel for publishing legally obtained information about the man who opened fire at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School last February.
Almost all, if not all, of the information that was contained in that report had already been leaked in some way or another. It was already public and publicly available.
I find that explanation completely unacceptable. You acted in bad faith, and ma'am, you came into this court, and you are always very professional, you're very respectful, and you gave this court the impression that everybody was on the same page as to what should and should not be disclosed. So then for you to turn around, and if you're the lawyer that the Sun Sentinel is saying that they met with before they published it, that told them go ahead and publish it, I find that to be an ethical violation on your part under the Florida bar. Maybe the Sun Sentinel does not have any ethical rules that they have to follow, but you as a lawyer do have those rules. And if you gave them that advice, then shame on you. Because I assure you that the constitutional rights of Mr. Cruz and the state and the listed victims in this case outweigh the Sun Sentinel's belief that the public has a right to know about these types of things. Because members of the public include Mr. Cruz, the defense, the state, and all of those witnesses who have now could potentially be jeopardized because of your actions. And I will note that, as far as I know, you are the only paper who did that.
True, Your Honor, but we're the only paper that matters today.
So Judge Elizabeth Scherer, she was incredulous in her upbraiding of this paper's attorney, claiming she thought she was pretty clear in what they were allowed to print and what they weren't. Based on what you can tell from the reporting that you've seen around this, did the Sun Sentinel violate the order?
No, and frankly, although the judge, you know, might have a right to be incensed because she's trying to control the fairness of this upcoming trial, legally, she's wrong. I mean, the Supreme Court has said that journalists may publish information that they receive legally, and they received it legally. They didn't steal it, and so they have a right to publish it. Did the paper violate sort of the ethics, as she was suggesting? I don't know. It seems to
me. That's open for debate, yeah. You know, whether or not they actually violated the ethics. I mean, they obtained the information under the parameters that was set forth by the judge. And it was the school district that put it in a format that allowed them to have this information. And then for the judge to turn around and, you know, blame the newspaper for doing its job. I mean, it's chapter and verse under the Supreme Court rulings that, you know, go back, you know, at least two or three cases yeah. that they did what journalists are supposed to do.
So for me, the key question is, did the information in that report that they managed to find through technological means, did it have enough public importance that it outweighed the alleged detriment to the defendant in that case. And I would say if you read the report, which is available online, and you see that from about the age of 3 until he committed the acts, that the suspect, the killer in this case, had a very troubled relationship, and the school district, try as it might have tried all through the time, there were some steps where maybe some things got through that shouldn't have gotten through.
And it sort of goes against what the school district was saying, was that we did all the right things. Yeah. Well, according to your own records, you released legally and was printed legally by the newspaper, there were some issues there.
So the technological aspect of this that we haven't really laid out for our audience is that it was made available to them in a PDF when the PDF was downloaded and then exported as a Word document, certain aspects of it that had it been perhaps given as a paper document and somebody took a Sharpie to it, some of those...
Some of that information.
Some of that redacted information became visible when the document...
All of it did.
Some of the redacted information to then become the source document was then visible. So the Sun Sentinel really didn't... It came upon what it was supposed to come upon, and they did what they were supposed to do with it.
I mean, I will say this much. First of all, the judge did not bring up the lawyer, you know, with the Florida bar. The judge did not cite the newspaper in contempt of court.
No.
She gave him a tongue lashing, but that's all legally she probably could do.
Right.
On the other hand, I mean, journalists got to be really careful about how they explain these stories, because lots of times we're out there beating the drum for following the rule of law when somebody when somebody's out there, say, trying to violate somebody's civil rights to keep them from voting, or they're trying to say, well, you can't have a public official who refuses to marry same-sex couples. The rule of law has to be applied in all kinds of cases. So if you believe that this didn't violate the law, you better tell your audience and convince terms that it didn't.
Right. And how and why.
Yeah.
Jack Dorsey, Twitter's CEO, did those sit-down interviews that we'd been talking about last week, the ones where he was going to try and smooth things over and talk about his vision for the platform and how he saw his team cleaning up some of the incivility and threats that were being made there.
You know, we've seen all these issues on the service. We've seen abuse, we've seen trolling, we've seen harassment, we've seen misinformation, and it came to a point where we felt we were playing whack-a-mole. We're just, you know, and also just addressing the surface level behaviors and symptoms rather than looking deeper at the second order drivers. What's behind all these actions? And we wanted something that was really tangible, that could be comprehensive of everything that we're seeing. So we were asked a question, what if you could what if you could measure the health of a conversation? And we think we can, because we all know when we've been in a conversation that has felt toxic that we want to walk away from. And that's an indicator. We've been in conversations that don't feel toxic, that feel empowering, that we want to stay in. That's an indicator. So if we can measure that, then we can measure our progress, and then we can actually understand if we're helping.
He was talking at one point in that whole interview that you can look at the whole thing on our links blog about how proud he is of some of the conversations that are going on what he calls NBA Twitter, communities in which people are talking about the NBA, or K-pop Twitter, Korean pop music. And I just kept thinking, okay, so he's paying attention to basketball and pop music from Korea. Am I in the wrong circles where I'm only paying attention to political Twitter, and is it the only cesspool?
Well, I mean, if you really listen to that clip when he's talking about these conversations, you know, where people want to walk away and where people want to engage, well, if you look at what's happening from a business standpoint with Twitter, you got people walking away.
I'm one of them.
You know, and that is what he's really trying to deal with in going out and talking to the media and talking about, here's how we're going to try to change the algorithms, change the way in which we allow people in and out of Twitter. It's really, to me, it just seems all about, we've got to get in front of the damage that has been caused by the trolls and by the constant, you know, Twitter wars that are going on in the political arena, most of it being led by the president.
I think he can mean both of those things at the same time, that he wants, you know, more open and friendly conversations and that he needs to protect his business. But it seems to me that, you know, even if he's willing to take the hit, he needs to describe in some more detail what he's actually doing. You know, well, we're scrubbing bots and suspicious accounts. How are you doing those things?
And how effective is it? You know.
Well, Facebook apparently has a new means to measure trustworthiness for each of its one point however many billion users there are right now. It's adding a trustworthiness scale with a range from 0 to 1 that evaluates what you post, whether it's real or fake, truthful or content that has since been debunked. I'm not going to lie, I'm really curious to know what my number is or some of the accounts that I follow, but the way Facebook is setting this up, we're never going to know because they don't want anybody trying to game the algorithm.
Well, and talk about sort of instant feedback. So earlier today, Facebook comes back and says, well, you know, we didn't mean that we're creating a trustworthiness score for people. We're just using this information to try to help to head off fake news content so it doesn't get the kind of play it wants. Because nobody, especially a company that's hard hit like Facebook right now, wants to say, oh, we're going to measure how trustworthy you are as individuals. So,
but we're not going to tell you how we're measuring.
How we're doing it, yeah.
Okay, well, it's the end of August, which means it's just about time for college and professional football time, and no one is feeling the pressure of the NFL preseason more than ESPN, as it tries to patch up a pretty strained relationship that it has right now with the National Football League. Its new president says that he wants its staffers at ESPN to focus far more on football and keep politics out of the broadcast and online offerings.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sorry, but it's just not going to happen because, you know, again, sports has always had a connection to culture and to politics and to basically the lives of people. And in this environment, it is going to be difficult for them to be able to just focus in on the sports because you have a significant number of the actual athletes mm-hmm. who play the sports who are basically saying, you know what, we're going to use our platform to engage in the social consciousness and the social justice issues that are plaguing our country.
And at that point, what's ESPN going to do? Go to commercial every time somebody takes a knee and stop televising the national anthem?
They actually came out and said they weren't going to do the national anthem. They aren't going to televise it. It's not going to be on. And he went and told the NFL owners that.
At which point, then the athletes are going to find another way if that becomes a uniform protest or something else that's going to show up and make it just as difficult. And then you also still have somebody say like Jemele Hill, who how many times in the last year and a half have we talked about comments that she has made that have led to suspensions? That's one person. What happens as this continues and we head into the new season?
I mean, the NFL makes a lot of money for ESPN.
Yeah,
of course.
Okay, that's fine. But if that's all they're known for is covering the NFL and they're not going to be covering sports, you know, as a news topic, mm-hmm. then they're going to lose some significant audience and some significant protections
right.
if they're not doing sports journalism. They're just broadcasting games.
Right. Talk a little bit about what you mean. Maybe give an example of one of those protections.
Well, I mean, I think they're being given the benefit of the doubt in some circles in terms of regulation, for mm-hmm. example, because they're doing sports journalism. If they start silencing those kinds of stories, I think that the political support that they might otherwise get, they might lose.
Yeah, and I mean, the NFL has basically came out in support of what the president is saying, at least some of the owners have, and now they're trying to walk that back.
President Trump, not the ESPN president.
Right. The President Trump,
and we I got think a lot of presidents
yeah, here. And part of the problem that many of the NFL owners has now is that they, you know, they got one audience they're trying to serve, and they're trying to serve another. They've got issues all over the place.
Okay, well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of our topics and some we didn't get to on our Links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave comments or questions, see what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for composing our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. See you next week for another edition of Views of the News.